Welcome back to the Athenaeum Review. I'm here with John Mraz, and we're talking about photography in Mexico. I was reading a little bit of an interview with you and sort of how you got into the field, and I guess that you'd worked at a steel mill and you'd worked building a dam, and you had maybe a broader variety of experience than maybe, let's say, a lot of academics. And I just wanted to ask, do you think having this sort of breadth of experience, I'm sure it must inform the way you sort of see your work and being a professor and all that?
Well, I think, to begin with, I had the enormous fortune to be thrown out of my first three universities. and then I went in the Army, 63, before Vietnam, thank God, for 3 years, got sent to Italy. So when I got out of the Army in 66, I had already worked in a steel mill. And, and when I got out of the Army in 66, I went up to work on a dam. Yes, when I went back to the university, I was older, and I could appreciate what an extraordinary experience being allowed to go to the university is. I mean, so many people just party away those four years, you know, which is what I would have done, except I'm an extremist, you know. I didn't do anything but party, you know. So when I came back, I really wanted to learn. And I had, you know, I had the good fortune, you know, it's always a process of elimination, you know. What don't you want to do, or what can't you do? I was going to be a doctor. I couldn't understand chemistry 1A, you know, and so I couldn't do that. English seemed to me to be really arbitrary. I couldn't understand sociology. It was all, you know, very functionalist sociology at the time. And I got into history, and history seemed to me to be a wonderful field, because if you could amass the evidence, you could make your point. And why Latin American history? Well, I'd lived in Mexico, and I'd liked Mexico. And I'd had U.S. history shoved down my throat for 4 years in high school. European history, everything seemed to be done, you know, and Latin American history seemed to be an open field. Then and actually I come from two generations, in the sense that I graduated in 61. When I went to UCLA, which was my first university, it was full of old white men teaching. Everything was an extremely conservative society. Right. When I came back from work, you know, back from the Army, back from working on the dam, it was a very, very different society. Love and peace, the protests against the Vietnam War, and all those things, you know, came together in a way. For instance, I had smoked grass in Mexico in 62. I loved it. I thought that was wonderful, you know. When I got out of the Army, when I got back down to California, everybody's smoking pot. And, and I remember I was at Orange Coast College, a junior college, you know, make up my grade. And I went to hear a talk by the Newport Beach Police Department about the horrors of marijuana, you know. And when I confronted them afterwards, they said, and I bet you're against the Vietnam War, too. You know, well, I come from a wealthy family. My father was a doctor, but he became wealthy because he moved to California in 40, bought land, and, sold it at 1,000 times what he bought it for, you know. So that was the beginning of my political consciousness. I said, well, maybe I should be against it, you know. My wife at that time was Swedish, and of course, you know, you're out, you know, Swedes are generally, you know, decent thinking people. They think they like democracy. So, you know, and it was a whole different thing. And then in 70 or so, a professor came to Santa Barbara, Jesus Chavarria, who was the guy who founded the first Mexican Chicano Studies Center in the United States, there at UC Santa Barbara, and he was a Marxist. He wrote a book on José Carlos Mariátegui, the Peruvian Marxist. He was, of course, run out of U.S. academia. At that same time, I started making films. Now, the minute I made my first audiovisual, which must have been absolutely wretched, you know, I said, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. And I started making historical films on Super 8. We could get them into Congresses. You couldn't get into a Congress as a graduate student in those days, you know. We were invited to write about them. You couldn't publish as a graduate student in those days. I had been admitted directly to the doctorate, but I said, I'm going to do a film as a dissertation, you know, and I proposed it, and I tried to back it up with both theoretical excuses, you know, Hayden White, postmodernism, you know, the writing of history is an acritically assumed paradigm, you know, and on the other hand, split brain theory, you know, that the left brain writes, the right brain looks at images, you know, that sort of stuff. We ought to do history with both of them, you know. Well, they didn't like that. So after 5 years, they gave me a terminal master's. And I didn't know where I was going to go, but I had the enormous good fortune to go to UC Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. And there I worked with a professor in film who did visual style analysis. And so that, to me, just hit like a, you know, that was like a hand in a mm-hmm. glove. I had found what I wanted to do, you know, and I was not, you know, I think that if you ever find what you want to do with your life, and how many of us really are able to do that? 2% maybe, you know, you have to hold on to that. You know, you have to say, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it whatever it costs.
Yeah.
I spent 5 years there in Santa Cruz. There weren't any jobs, so there was no reason to leave Santa Cruz, which is a beautiful, beautiful place. You know, I was having the time of my life. But after being there 5 years, it was time to move on. I went to Berkeley. Again, had no idea what I was going to do. A Mexican woman came to visit a friend. We met one another. We spent a week together. She went back to Mexico. I was doing leftist video. I was doing work for, I was earning my money doing video on multi-ethnic multi-ethnic school research, you know, research in multi-ethnic education. But that was my day job. But the fun I was having was working in a radical collective called Grand Illusions, documenting the hotel restaurant workers' strike, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of a thing. And at some point, somebody came to me and said, well, would you be willing to smuggle sound equipment into Mexico? And I said, why not? I'd been in the black market in Italy more for adventure than when I was in the army, you know, more for adventure than making money. Yeah. And I had no idea what it was they put on the plane, you know. Yeah. When I got to Mexico City, it was like speakers, you know, like half, you know, if you put the two speakers together, they would be that wall, you know. And the soundboard was like from this wall to that wall. Yeah. You know, it was like enormous, you know. Well, of course, it was taken away, you know, immediately. And I spent like about a week, very surrealistic week, going from government office to government office with the guys that had asked me to bring it for Peña Morelos. And trying to get a hold of Ellie, the woman that I had been with in San Francisco. Well, finally, I got a hold of her, and she came, and she picked me up and took me to her house in Coyoacan. I'd never seen Coyoacan. I said, wow, this is really great, you know.
Yeah.
Well, do you want to come back and live here? Okay. So I went back to San Francisco, thought it over for a month, you know. It's a big step, you know.
Yeah.
But my philosophy of life is you can either be bored or scared, you know, and I prefer scared. So, you know, I rolled the dice, moved to Mexico to live with somebody that I'd known a week, and we have been together 37 years. Not easy, but, you know, never is. But Mexico's a very funny place.
Mm-hmm.
Mexico things function on palancas. Enchufes, connections.
Yeah.
Ellie Bartra is like the founder, one of the founders of Mexican feminism.
Mm-hmm.
Her brother and cousin are among the very most important Latin American intellectuals. So with those kind of connections, you know, she said, what are you going to do for work? I don't know. She said, well, wouldn't you like to work in television? Oh, okay. We go over to Churubusco Studios. We meet Vicente. Vicente says, here's 13 programs I have. Which one do you want to be in? Well, this is sort of more like documentary. Okay, you want to be director or producer? I'm just off the plane. I don't even speak Spanish, you know? And, you know, that was wonderful. I traveled all over Mexico. I learned Spanish, you know. I sat up every night drinking with the entire crew. That's also how Mexican men bond. You drink.
Yeah.
Seriously. and when that job ended, again, Palanca, the wife of the founder of the Labor Studies Institute was a professor in the University of LA, said there's a job in publication. I went over to see him. He said, publication, why would he? I showed him, I gave him my vita,
right,
because I had always published all the time. I had always made films, I'd always produced. One, because I like it. Two, because as Bob Dylan said, to live outside the law, you must be honest, you know? And that means if you're doing something different, you better produce twice as much as anybody else, you know?
Yeah.
And that's why, even though I didn't agree with Obama's neoliberal imperial policies, I thought, hey, a black man who gets to be president has got to be twice as smart as any white man. Well, he's about 200 times as smart as Trump, no? But same men, same with women, too.
Yeah.
Enrique says, he said, don't you want to be the coordinator of visual history?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay, that's settled. Let's go to my house. And we went to his house to watch the World Cup and drink.
Yeah.
And once Enrique and I began to drink together, we became good friends, and I was producing a lot, so that worked. When that institute was ended in 1982, because it was a government institute, new president came in, I didn't know what I was going to do, and Enrique said, you take the photo archive with you. It's your archive. You made it. It's just going to be thrown into a closet and thrown away. So I did. And I used that eventually to get into the University of Puebla, which at that point in time was the communist university in Mexico. Now it's the neoliberal university in Mexico. So we get paid on time, but it's not as much fun.
Right.
And it's been it's really been incredible in terms of being allowed to do what I want to do, to get sent to Nicaragua to make a film, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, John, you want to go to Nicaragua and make a film? Oh, yeah, why not? Yeah, great, okay. You go, the Sandinista government will give you a crew for 10 days. You shoot whatever you want. I arrive at Nicaragua. I say, okay, I'm here. Okay, what's the film on? They go, you're the filmmaker. It's on what you want, you know. And I thought for a bit, you know, I said, well, I'm going to do, you know, a denunciation of the horrible, horrible atrocities committed by the freedom fighters, the Contra, that Reagan funded with crack money. And then I said, no. The incredible thing about a revolution is that there's an energy that is loosened. We, you know, they say that we work with 10% of our mind. We really work with 10% of what we could really be, you know? And you see that in a post-revolutionary period because people are able to be themselves more fully, you know? That's the effervescence, you know, that lasts a while. And that's what I saw then, and I said, that's what I'm going to focus on, the innovators movement. And I did, and I made the film. And then I made a railroad film, and then I made a film on Ellie. When I was in the University of Barcelona as a visiting professor, I made a film on Ellie's, well, these are all videotapes. We use film is just shorthand now because, you know, there's all different media. We thought videotapes was going to be permanent. On Ellie's grandfather, who had been a pioneer Catalan filmmaker, that sort of stuff. And so, and now I made the one on Julio. So I make films when I can, but I don't want to be like Orson Welles. The comparison is ridiculous. Orson Welles says, I didn't make films in my life. I looked for money to make films.
Yeah.
And in Mexico, the incredible thing is that I'm constantly invited to do things. So I'm invited to be the curator of the national exhibit for the centennial of the Mexican Revolution. If you can imagine a gringo being invited to do that. I mean, now I'm a Mexican. I have dual citizenship. But, you know, and so I'm invited to do exhibits. I'm invited to make films. And at the same time, I have, you know, my own projects that are happening. And, you know, right now, the book I'm doing, it will be called, it'll be for the University of Texas Press, that will be called Doing History with Modern Media, a Personal Trip. Because I decided I, I didn't, another, you know, I signed a contract to do a thing on analyzing photographs. And I decided I don't really need another academic book. You know, I'm old and I'm top-level professor and top-level national researcher, you know. So I decided to do sort of an autobiography, although I'm looking at photographs too. And I think that photography is enormously, enormously important. The problem when we think about photography is that we think about photography as art. Uh-huh. Photography is not art. Right. Photography is a medium, right. You know. Art photographs may comprise 2% of all the photographs that exist, you know. But because of interests that have been created, and created by museums, by galleries, and by art history departments, we think of photography as art. Whereas basically, it's not at all art, you know. And so I think that every single discipline has to develop a visual component. We live in a hyper-visual world, and we don't know how to read these things. And they're putting things, they are making us think in very particular ways, and we are ignorant of that, you know. And that's very, very dangerous. Yeah. Like I say, every single discipline has to have the visual component.
Yeah.
Today, by and large, the people who write books about photography either come from art and their methodologies are irrelevant, you know, or they come from literary studies and posmo, you know.
Right.
Well, what in the hell has literary theory got to do with image? It has nothing whatsoever to do with it. It's an error, you know.
Yeah.
So what they do is just a template. You take Derrida, Guattari, Deleuze, and you apply it to photographs. You know, you don't do any real research, you know. You just apply it, you know. I think that historians have a particular opportunity to develop the analysis of photography and use it in very particular ways, not just to illustrate texts, you know, but to get into those texts, find out what's being said by them. And basically, we analyze photography from two standpoints. We analyze photography from without by a contextualist approach, which is to say photographs float. A photograph in and of itself means absolutely nothing.
Right.
Or a photograph means anything you want it to mean in terms of the context you give it. Usually written, you know. So it can mean one thing in one context and precisely the opposite in another context, you know. From within, we analyze photographs by comparing them. We compare a photograph, for instance, of the piropo, the compliments that men give to women in the street in Mexico or in Rome, you know.
Yeah.
With another photograph of that same type in order to, how do we understand which angle they're shot from, how much space the person has around them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So the problem is this, is that the great universities are not going to develop visual studies.
Yeah.
Basically, because the faculty is too entrenched, has too much prestige, and they don't know what to do with it. They don't have the faintest idea of how to approach it. You know? So Harvard, Yale, Oxford, Duke, the Sorbonne, the UNAM, they don't have photographic programs.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they even deal with photography, it's in the art department.
Yeah.
You know, which, as I say, is irrelevant to the mass of photographs, as Bordeaux said. Two-thirds of all photography is family photography. Okay, how are we going to analyze family photography? Photojournalism, enormous. How are we going to analyze photojournalism? Every single genre of photography is going to require its specific methodology of analysis. And within that genre, that will be done in terms of the function that it has served, you know, or that it serves. And so the book right now, for instance, in terms of what genres have I decided to focus on? I've decided to focus on Indianist photography, photographs made of the indigenous peoples by non-indigenous people, revolutionary, photographs made in a revolution, and worker leftist decolonizing photography. Mm-hmm. And another very broad chapter, which is how generally historians can approach photography, and sort of the initial chapter, which explains, how would I put it, which is my search, right, of how I eventually arrived. How did I end up in photography rather than film, for instance? And that was just also serendipity.
Yeah.
When I was out of work, I was out of work for a year in 1983, inflation of 100%, you know, things are just crazy. I went to the Filmoteca of the UNAM. I thought, well, hey, my doctorate is in film. It was on the representation of history in Cuban cinema between 65-70. I'll try to get a job here, and that guy just shut the door in my face. Whereas the founding director of the Fototeca Nacional opened the door and said, John, please come, we'll pay you to come and teach classes about photography, and we'll pay you to write a book about Nacho Lopez.
Yeah.
So that, to a certain extent, and also the great thing about photography, I mean, today you can see a film at the speed you want.
Right.
But when I began working on film, you had to sit in darkened rooms.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
some of us even had lights on our pens,
yeah,
you know, so that you could be taking notes while the film was being projected, you know. Today you can stop the film. But I like photography because you can, you know, it's there at your pace. You can look at it, you can understand, you can contextualize it. I just find it a lot more interesting than I do film. So that's why I like making films, but I don't like looking for the money to make films. So that's basically how I ended up in photography. But you know, as I said, we live in a hyper-visual world. We simply have to find ways of incorporating all these new media into our studies because these companies are putting things in our heads.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about this. I was in Colombia recently, and I was giving an interview there. And it suddenly occurred to me, why did I marry this Swedish woman that I married, who I met in the army? You know, I mean, she was absolutely stunningly beautiful, you know. But the reason I married her was because of a Noxema commercial from 1967 that said, she wasn't Swedish, but she faked the Swedish accent. And it was a woman shaving, you know, Noxema shaving cream. Yeah. Take it off. Take it all off, you know. These things get in our heads, you know, and we don't know where they come from, and we don't know how to defend ourselves against them because we don't know how to read them. We don't know how to look at them. Seeing what you are looking at requires an enormous amount of work. It is enormously difficult to see visually, to really see. And once it happens, people go, oh, that's obvious.
Right.
You know,
right.
My dissertation, a woman who I worked in visual studies told a wonderful story. She did visual analysis of John Ford's films.
Yeah.
And in his greatest film, The Searchers, with John Wayne, she said, well, there's a sort of a hint of a romantic frisson between the wife of John Wayne's brother and John Wayne. And her dissertation advisor, who came from literature, because there were no film studies in those days, the early 70s, said, that's nonsense. And she said, no, you come with me. And they sat down and they looked at the movie with no sound.
Yeah.
And she said, look how she strokes his coat.
Uh-huh.
And the guy goes, oh, yeah, but that's obvious. Well, it was obvious then,
afterwards.
But it wasn't obvious until she had done that research. And that's visual research. So we have to move from using visuals as illustrations, you know, for our writing thinking. We're in a third stage now. We are post-literate, you know. We are visual, we are audio, you know.
Yeah.
It's technical images. So who do we who can we look at? We can look at Wilhelm Flusser. We can look at John Berger. We can look at Walter Benjamin. We can look at Ariel Azoulay. You know, these are the kind of theoreticians we need, not these old worn out literary theory people. We're in a post-literate world. I love literature, you know. I also love to be able to understand what I'm reading.
Yeah.
And when I try to read Posmo, I feel stupid.
Yeah.
I'm not stupid.
Yeah.
And I have written, you know, by the time you get to my age, you say, hey, it's either my fault or your fault. And it's like Nietzsche said. What did Nietzsche? He says, those who are profound and those who wish to appear profound. Those who are profound express themselves in the clearest way they can so that you can see the depth of their profundity.
Yeah.
Those who wish to appear profound express themselves in the most obscure way they can so that you cannot see that they have no profundity.
Yeah.
And that's what I find with people from Posmo,
is that
let's make it as complicated as we can so it's enormously elitist. Yeah. You have to spend years trying to understand what they're saying, and they don't even know what they're trying to say. You've heard of the Sokol affair. My heavens, that proved it.
Yeah.
They published nonsense, and then the guy came out and said it was nonsense, and then the editors defended it and said it wasn't nonsense, and the guy said, hey, I know when I'm writing nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, there is no reality.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So if you live in Mexico, you know there's reality.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the great thing about living in Mexico is that death is very near, you know. And so you live, when you live close to death, you live with a passion, with an intensity of enjoying every minute of it, you know, because tomorrow it could be gone.
Yeah.
And I love, I don't like his films that much, but I love what Guillermo del Toro said when a woman said, was interviewing him, and she said, well, you know, you see this dark side and everything, and yet you're so funny and you're so warm. How do you explain this? And it's like, boom, it's impromptu.
Yeah.
I'm Mexican. You know, it's like after the earthquake right now, they're interviewing a Portuguese woman. And she said, I've lived in this city for 4 years. I didn't know this city until this earthquake. I've never seen social solidarity like this.
Yeah.
And not only is it social solidarity, everybody bringing food, everybody helping everybody. It's a party.
Yeah.
She said, these people know how to live. You know? And I think that, as I say, I had the enormous good fortune of not being able to get a job in the United States and being able to move, you know, and being able to live in Mexico, which I think is a very, very, an extraordinarily interesting place.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the site, Cholula is the site of the longest occupied place in the Western Hemisphere, you know. So the Mexican civilization has extraordinary roots, and it has extraordinary cultural roots, you know, with the folk art, you know, that sort of stuff. I mean, it's no surprise that so many of the past Oscars have gone to Mexican directors and Mexican cinematographers.
Yeah.
It's a visual culture, you know, and it's a creative culture, and it's an innovative culture, you know. So there's always innovation that has to be going on, you know. There's never, you can't do that, you know.
Yeah.
And there's always a joy of being alive, you know. And I think that if the exhibit, you know, what I wanted to do with the exhibit was show how Mexicans had always lived in this country and had always been an important part of the American workforce, the American sick workforce.
Right.
But more than that, you know, or alongside that, I think Mexicans also bring a particular way of looking at the world. And I think that that's a very healthy way of looking at the world, a much healthier way of looking at the world than the WASP way of looking at the world.
Yeah.
So, as I say, that for me has been a very fortunate situation.
This is the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. John Mraz has curated the exhibition on the braceros as seen by Los Hermanos Mayo. Oscar Olson is our engineer, and John Mraz's visit to UT Dallas was made possible by the Center for U.S. Latin American Initiatives. The Athenaeum Review is produced by Creative Disturbance and the UT Dallas School of Arts and Humanities. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.